This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of June 18th, here are a few top stories. In the news, faced with rising drug overdose deaths, states like Arizona have focused on limiting the number of opioid pills doctors can prescribe. But now, some worry the new rules are creating another crisis, and patients are becoming collateral damage. KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
It started with a rolled ankle during a routine training exercise. Shannon Hubbard never imagined it was the prologue to one of the most debilitating chronic pain conditions, called complex regional pain syndrome.
It basically makes my leg feel like it's on fire pretty much all the time. It spreads to different parts of your body.
The 47-year-old military veteran who lives outside Phoenix props up her swollen leg, careful not to graze it against the kitchen table. It's still scarred from an ulcer that landed her in the hospital a few months ago.
That started in as a little blister, and 4 days later, it was like the size of a baseball.
Soon, it will happen again. Hubbard's disease causes the nervous system to go haywire, creating pain disproportionate to the actual injury.
Anything your body sees as trauma, it could be a simple needle prick.
It's often referred to as the suicide disease because it's so unbearable. There's no cure. All you can do is treat the pain. An elusive search that's left Hubbard with a plastic bag filled with discarded pill bottles.
Here is a sample of some of the drugs that I've tried over the last 3 years.
More than 60 at last count. But after years of trial and error, Hubbard did find one thing that helped, a combination of long and short-acting opioids. She was taking that for 9 months, until recently, when, at her monthly appointment, Hubbard was informed by her pain doctor her dose was being lowered.
They didn't indicate that there was any medical reason for cutting me back. It was simply the pressure because of the opioid rules going into effect.
Hubbard knew about those new rules, part of Arizona's opioid law, which limits the maximum dose doctors can prescribe most patients. She also knew it wasn't supposed to affect her, an existing patient with chronic pain. She pushed back, but with no success.
The only thing that helps is the one thing they won't give you. So it's just frustrating.
Hubbard's condition may be extreme, but her situation is not unique. Faced with skyrocketing drug overdoses, states like Arizona are cracking down on opioid prescribing. Last year, Governor Doug Ducey declared a public health emergency and pushed through a broad law aimed at everything from expanding addiction treatment to more closely regulating prescribers. Before it passed, flanked by Democrats and Republicans, Ducey pledged,
"We will maintain access for chronic pain sufferers and others who rely on these drugs."
Unfortunately, I've heard from my colleagues that there are patients who are not doing well.
Julian Grove is a pain doctor and president of the Arizona Pain Society.
We're finding a portion of patients who have been decades on a stable pain management regimen and now being reduced, not for a clinical perspective, but more for a legal and regulatory perspective for fear of investigation.
So while Grove knows Arizona's law wasn't meant to stop legitimate doctors from prescribing to legitimate patients, he says the reality is
the environment was changing at such a rapid pace, whether it was the federal government, Medicare guidelines, separate commercial guidelines, that the reduction of opioids, it made that more fast and furious.
The rules come as the rate of opioid prescribing nationally is at its lowest in years, and more people are dying from illicit drugs like heroin and fentanyl than prescription opioids. In Arizona, only about one-third of overdoses in the past year involved just a prescription painkiller. Dr. Sally Sattell is a psychiatrist and fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
It's a very, very unhealthy, deeply chilled environment.
Sattell says this hypervigilance goes back to a set of guidelines for primary care physicians from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in 2016. Those spelled out the risks associated with higher doses of opioids and advised when starting a patient on the medicine to prescribe the lowest effective dose. But Sattell says those guidelines have also been misinterpreted.
There is no mandate to reduce doses on people who have been doing well.
Yet, in the rush to address the overdose crisis, the guidelines have become the model for many state laws.
They're often looked to as a kind of strategy that can make an enormous impact on the problem. And that is not true.
Instead, more people may turn to illegal drugs as doctors dial back prescribing. In fact, the number of opioid prescriptions in Arizona decreased by 33% in April as compared to the same month last year. And prescriptions for high doses of opioids fell by 50%. That makes sense to Shannon Hubbard. She's part of that statistic. Now at a lower dose, she says the pain is terrible.
It just hurts. I don't want to walk. I don't want to, pretty much don't want to do anything.
Except hold out hope for a change and try to wait out the pain. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You can hear more stories and follow our in-depth coverage of Arizona's opioid epidemic at kjzz.org. In science news, water leaders in Arizona are trying to get to yes on a deal that deals with drought. This comes after a year of disagreement and anxiety over the future of Colorado River policy. And as KJZZ's Brett Jaspers reports, the rest of the basin is watching intently.
First, a brief recap. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey held a series of meetings last year on water. Some people criticized their secrecy. Secret or not, the meetings ended in a stalemate between the state's Department of Water Resources and the Central Arizona Project, the agency that brings river water to the Phoenix and Tucson areas. The legislative session produced no results on water. A pair of impatient, angry letters came in from the upper basin. Progress was frozen. Time to reboot. Now, state water leaders have been talking for about a month, and federal officials will visit Tempe next week for a briefing on the Colorado River. The two people steering the ship are Tom Bouchatsky, the director of water resources, and Ted Cook, who runs the CAP.
On the one hand, I don't want to say that the only reason that Tom and I are embarking on this initiative is because we've been pressured to do so by folks. On the other hand, I don't want to say it's a complete coincidence of timing.
The pressure from outside Arizona, Bouchatsky said, isn't do this or else, but a reminder that negotiations are way better than, say, lawsuits.
When the states moved with the federal government into that paradigm, away from let's have a bunch of big fights and litigation, we better control their own destiny.
Fights and litigation would only delay a coordinated response to continued high temperatures and slipping water levels in Lake Mead and Lake Powell. The entire region is eager to sign a so-called drought contingency plan, a deal that would give users more flexibility in preparing for drier times. The other states are mostly waiting on Arizona.
The situation in Arizona is a topic of a lot of discussion in the Upper Basin.
Jim Lockhead is the CEO of Denver Water, that city's water utility. He said Arizona's internal conflict has led to political problems in Colorado.
It puts pressure on Denver Water as a municipal utility, taking water out of the Colorado River, and it exacerbates historic animosities and relationships between Western Colorado and Denver Water.
Lockhead sent a letter to the Central Arizona Project in April threatening to pull out of a program to conserve water unless the lower basin made real progress on its plan. Shortage is so imminent, California has even agreed to take reductions, something the current rules don't require it to do. Pat Mulroy was a longtime water leader in Nevada and is now at UNLV.
And you have to ask yourself, given the position that you are in, why would you let that opportunity go by?
But before it can sign a lower basin plan, Arizona needs its own internal deal. To get to yes, Bouchatsky and Cook say they'll have to avoid letting side issues divert the talks. After all, there are plenty of main dishes to chew over. One is what to do about farmers in central Arizona who would take a big hit under the current rules. Ted Cook.
And how do we find a way to make things less painful for them? Not completely painless, but less painful.
Another big issue, who gets to decide when certain conserved water stays on Lake Mead? Tom Bouchatsky, then Cook.
And who makes that decision on whether the water stays in the lake or not is still under discussion, I would say.
Under discussion?
Yeah, we'll work it out. We will work that out.
It's a negotiation, after all. Bouchatsky characterized his task this way.
Defined a collective way to create a package where everyone is better off with the package, even though there might be individual pieces of that package that they might not particularly like 100%.
By rebooting negotiations, Arizona gets another chance at writing something it can live with. Brett Jaspers, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the KJZZ original production, The Show, here's host Steve Goldstein.
The scourge of Alzheimer's disease is growing as people live longer. In the U.S. alone, an estimated 5.7 million have Alzheimer's-related dementia. Extensive research is being done to learn more about how to identify and treat it, including here in Arizona. A team of interdisciplinary researchers came together to form the Human Computation Institute to figure out what to do about problems that humans could solve but computers couldn't, or that computers could solve but humans couldn't. One problem was connected to Alzheimer's, giving the team a unique opportunity. So with the help of a game called Stall Catchers and a citizen science project, research progress is being made. Pietro Michelucci is director of the Human Computation Institute and is with me to talk about it. Pietro, let's start with some background. What is the Human Computation Institute and how did you create it?
So the Human Computation Institute was created to meet the need for a center that brings together interdisciplinary scientists who are all working together from different vantage points to support a new kind of science called human computation, which is about creating distributed systems made up of machines and humans connected by the internet in order to solve problems that machines alone cannot solve and that humans alone cannot solve.
And how did Alzheimer's disease get to be at the core of this?
Shortly after founding the Institute, you know, we realized that you know, we had the right people together, and we thought we had some ideas about how to use these techniques of combining computers and humans to solve problems. But we were looking for an actual problem to solve, and a colleague of mine, Janice Dickinson from Cornell University, happened to have a chance meeting with a biomedical researcher also at Cornell at a faculty function, and she learned about his work, and she knew that we were looking for a problem to solve that would have significant societal impact. She set up a meeting, and so you know, when I learned about his work that he was studying Alzheimer's disease, I thought, well, you know, this is the kind of problem that many people can get behind quite easily. I mean, most people have at least some connection to the disease and care about solving it. You know, part of creating a successful crowdsourcing system is to be able to motivate people to contribute to it, to volunteer their time, and so. You know, creating the right success conditions up front is part and parcel to that. The problem they had is that the kind of analysis that was required for their data was painstaking manual visual analysis by human lab technicians. And for each single experiment that they would run and for which they would collect data, it would take an entire year to analyze the data, which is, by research standards, is a glacial pace of advancement. So this sounded to me like the kind of problem that would indeed lend itself to a human computation approach where we could potentially leverage the cognitive abilities of many people in order to solve this problem.
Are there any built-in extra risks that come with that? Obviously, there is an efficiency quotient which helps. There's the quickness with which it can help. But are there any special requirements that a person must have?
I think there can be, and you know, for every success case we have with a platform like this, we probably have many failure cases. So in fact, I recently ran a workshop with a few colleagues to try to sort of organize these concepts and figure out how can we learn from our successes and failures. But I think one key concept has to do with data quality. Whenever you create a citizen science platform, and in our case, a game called Stall Catchers, you know, which anyone can play, and in doing so, they help accelerate, you know, the Alzheimer's research. You're asking members of the general public without specialized training to analyze scientific data, and you're somehow supposed to extract very high quality, you know, research quality results from that analysis. So how can you do that? And one approach that we take is what we call wisdom of crowd methods. And this is the idea that if you get one person to analyze a piece of data, that might or might not be accurate. But if you can somehow combine their answer sensibly with many other answers, all of different people looking at the same data, then you can potentially extract an expert-like result from that. And that's exactly what we've done in the Stall Catchers game is we had to figure out what we call our magic number. That is, you know, what we do is we show people a blood vessel in the brain of a mouse, and the simple task is to determine whether blood is flowing through that vessel or if it's stalled, which is why we call it stall catchers, where our needle in the haystack problem is finding the stalls. So we had to figure out how many different people have to look at the same blood vessel in order to get a highly accurate answer, one that met the stringent requirements of the Cornell researchers. And in our validation study, we discovered that through our simple combination method, it would take 20 different people looking at the same blood vessel to get a highly accurate result. We actually improved our efficiency by a factor of 3. So now it takes on average only 7 people looking at the same blood vessel to meet the data quality requirements.
Troy, in the big picture, what do you see as the future? It could be short term, could be longer term if you want, of this sort of human research combined with AI research and data collection. As things are refined, as things are figured out a little bit better, how impactful do you think it can be?
From my perspective, the writing is already on the wall in terms of moving toward a cognitive labor economy. In other words, through citizen science experiences. And now there are platforms that will allow people to study and learn a vocation through doing some kind of online cognitive task, and then ultimately get hired by the company that's crowdsourcing that task and continue to do the same work online and get paid for it. The future vision that I see is one in which we're increasingly moving in this direction where artificial intelligence is starting to do some of the more menial jobs. You know, we see driverless cars that are being controlled by AI, and that displaces cab drivers. On the other hand, it creates a new kind of job, which is cab drivers who are now working at a call center for Nissan. And the idea there is that when the driverless car encounters a situation it doesn't understand, it sends telemetry to the Nissan call center, and a human being actually, you know, takes over the car or analyzes the situation and provides the feedback that the AI needs. So I think what we're going to see is increasingly partnerships between computers and humans. And the role of humans is going to move gradually in this direction of jobs that I think are more stimulating and more interesting. So, yeah, I guess that's what I see for our future.
Pietro Michelucci is director of the Human Computation Institute. The Stall Catchers game has reached more than 10,000 participants at this stage.
From the business desk, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody on what helps an advertisement endure.
25 years ago, a fictitious Alexander Hamilton fan had the chance to win a lot of money by answering what was, for him, an easy question. The problem? He had just scarfed down about half a PB&J and had nothing with which to wash it down.
And now let's make that random call with today's $10,000 question. It's a tough one. Who shot Alexander Hamilton in that famous duel? All right, let's go to the phones and see who's out there.
Hello? Hello, for $10,000, who shot...
Alan Burr.
Excuse me?
Alan Burr. Oh, hold on, let me just look.
I'm afraid your time is almost up.
Alan Burr!
I'm sorry, maybe next time.
Got milk.
That ad campaign went on to feature several other commercials, not to mention a ton of other takes on that tagline. But what was it about those ads that still endures more than two decades after they first hit the airwaves? To help answer that question, I'm joined by Terry O'Reilly. He's the host of the CBC radio program Under the Influence, which looks at shifts in marketing. And Terry, in your mind, what makes a good and enduring ad campaign, not just for the immediate time it starts, but what makes it last into the future?
I think a couple of things. I think the campaign itself has to be rooted in a really meaningful strategy. That means the basic premise or the foundation of the campaign has to be meaningful to a large audience in some way or another. Then there's the X factor. What's the creativity? How is that strategy expressed creatively? But I think at the end of the day, I think there has to be an enormous amount of creativity. And there has to be a sticky factor. Something about that idea has to be sticky. Something about it has to be memorable or unusual or just kind of breaks through the usual clutter via some aspect of its execution.
Now, I think for a lot of people, especially in years gone by, that would be the jingle of a particular ad. Is it something like that now still, or is it something else, maybe some of the content of the advertisement itself?
I think there's some element of the advertising that works. You know, back in the day, jingles were a great way to do that, although they fell out of favor in the 80s when artists started licensing their music to advertising. That was the end of the jingle. But I would say there has to be some aspect. Either it's a tagline that catches on, or it's a character in an ad that people seem to love, and then they build a campaign around that. There has to be some element that just makes it stick up. Just to, you know, if you imagine a field of flowers and there's one sunflower sticking out of the rest of the pack, that's what an ad has to do. And and let me tell you, it's not easy.
I'm wondering about the creativity aspect that you talked about. And in terms of getting a campaign to endure, you know, tastes change and, you know, what was funny maybe 15 or 20 years ago might not be funny now. How do ad makers and maybe the companies themselves think about using creativity to make sure that it works at the time, but also to try to make sure that it will, you know, not fall out of favor and not just be seen as kind of lame later on?
Yeah, that's a very insightful question. So the answer to that is, you have to constantly worry about it. For a campaign to have legs, in other words, for a campaign to last years instead of just months, you have to have somebody overseeing it that is willing to let it evolve. That means a great idea has the ability to evolve, so it can take on different aspects as time goes on, or drop certain aspects of it if they fall out of favor. So it has to be some kind of malleable idea that can morph as time goes on.
We are right now sort of in the midst of the 25th anniversary of the Got Milk ad campaign. Can you tell me what it is about that particular campaign that, you know, people still talk about it? If you say Got Milk, people still know what you're talking about, and you see T-shirts and other ads and posters where Got just about everything else out there. What worked about this particular campaign?
I think a couple of things. First of all, Got Milk as a tagline, as a slogan, was very strange. If you know, we're all familiar with it now, but back then it was grammatically incorrect. it was a weird line. As a matter of fact, when it was first floated at Goodby and Silverstein, is the name of the agency that came up with it, when it was first floated, the line Got Milk, there was a lot of pressure from within the agency to change it to Have Milk? ? But the creative directors were very smart. They said, no, we're not going with that. And then I think the other thing about that campaign was just the underlying strategy about why that campaign worked. So milk sales were going down like crazy in California, milk consumption. So the milk board wanted to try and reverse that decline. So they started doing some research, and they realized that milk was so boring that in the world of beverages, there was no beverage more boring than milk. That's what their research told them, which every director of marketing is the worst news in the world.
Yeah, that's
right?
Not a good place to start.
So, it's not a good place to start. In other words, the director of marketing was very smart, though. He said, what if we put all our money into just getting people to eat more cereal? Like, that was one of his thoughts, which is very insightful. So in other words, let's not advertise milk. Let's advertise cereal, because if people eat more cereal, they'll drink more milk. And when they did more research, they realized that people always paired milk with a food, but the food always came first. It was cookies and milk, sandwiches and milk, brownies and milk. Milk made those meals perfect, but it was the second thing in the sequence. But if you took the milk out of the equation, it was a catastrophe. And Got Milk was always this reminder of don't get caught without it.
When ad makers are putting their commercials together and conceiving of them, do they look at them for the long term, or are they just trying to achieve a particular goal over weeks or months or maybe even 1 year?
Smart marketers are always looking at the long game. Amateur marketers, or marketers that are in trouble, look at tactics. And a tactic is just a short-term promotion. But smart marketers are always looking at the long game. In other words, how can I enhance my brand or enhance my product so I can build on this for the next 10 years? So that's always the smart marketer's game plan.
All right. Terry O'Reilly is host of the CBC radio program Under the Influence. Terry, really good to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Great talking to you, too. Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Education Desk,
The show's Steve Goldstein considers whether schools can be designed to protect kids.
The recent tragic shootings at U.S. schools have renewed discussions about how to keep students safe, including adding security or even arming teachers. But what about changing how the schools are designed? Should there be safe rooms or locations that lend themselves to easier escape routes? To learn more about the possibilities, I'm joined by Phil Horton. He's head of architecture at ASU's Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts. And Phil, where is the balance between designing a school that is safe but also that doesn't look like a prison?
A lot of architects specialize in K through 12 education and really understand how to make schools that both achieve a lot of the safety guidelines or goals, as well as trying to really make them beautiful, functional, and enjoyable environments. The thing that you talked about, or the point that you made there about looking like prisons, there's another version of the conversation, which is this question of how integral or how hermetic from the surrounding community should a school be. And I think a lot of contemporary thought is that schools have begun to be less integrated into their context, be more isolated from their communities, and that has other detrimental impacts and doesn't necessarily improve safety. And so I think there's a push right now to both maintain those safety guidelines, but to make sure that you're designing these environments to not be so hermetic that they're really isolated from the communities that they're serving.
So when it comes to these horrifying school shootings, and that's certainly part of the reason we're talking to you today, are there things that have come up in the last year or two that you've seen, or that you would say this is an interesting idea for doing some of the things that we said, where you are thinking safety, but you're also not making it feel like the kids are going to a place that no longer feels like a school, at least how we want a school to feel?
So when you're talking about strategies for school safety, there are typically a couple of ways to look at it. There are what we call active systems, the things like cameras and alarms, et cetera, which have become increasingly smart and increasingly easy to integrate into an existing school, and those work really well. And then there are the kind of passive or intuitive strategies about how do you just organize the classrooms, create nice straight wide corridors that are well lit so that you can see throughout the school. And I don't think that those have to be really specific to one type of safety concern, because concerns about bullying between students, concerns about students vandalizing school property, the goal is the same regardless of whatever the concern might be, that you want to be able to have transparency through the school, that you want to be able to distribute the faculty and staff throughout the school so that you don't have isolated corners within the school where activities that are really undesirable can occur.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how much input parents should have in this kind of thing or how much input they actually do have, but I mean, is there an importance when it comes to this for the schools, for the districts, whatever it may be, to share this with parents in terms of what the priorities may be and how something might work in order to design some things like we're talking about?
I do think that that's always been the case, but is increasingly the case currently. And I have a daughter who's 8 years old. She's going to be going into third grade. As we're touring her school, parents are asking questions about what do you do in the event of a lockdown, which is a sad way to be thinking about what the educational opportunities for your child are, but they're a kind of contemporary reality. And I think that in the design of schools, it's really important to understand that the built environment only is one lens through which you can think about public safety. Obviously, policy, mental wellness, access to wellness, economics, culture are all a big part of it. But architects, designers are inherently generalists. We're not experts in any one thing. You have to understand a little bit about human physiology, about social and behavioral science, about thermodynamics, statics, economics, supply chain management. And the job of the architect is to synthesize all of those things into the best solution for that school, for that place. But the earlier you involve a designer or an architect in the process, the earlier they can help to kind of see how some of the forethought that really precedes how many classrooms do we need or how big of a site do we need, but really some of the kind of strategic thinking that really informs some of those decisions, the more they can really help to bring that expertise to bear in a way that makes sure that you get the best possible outcome.
Is there something about the atmosphere of a school, the environment of a school, in the initial design when an architect puts together? You've talked a little bit about this, sort of the feel of it, but is there a tone that can be set early in the way that a school looks or the way the school is designed to help students, teachers feel at ease to some extent?
That question is not really an aesthetic question. It's not about how the school looks. It's about how it's organized. Mm-hmm. And how do you really create a sense of community within the design of a school? There are some big questions, I think, about how educational theory is evolving and whether or not our educational systems are really evolving the way that they could or should. You could make a clear argument that a lot of schools today, while they look different than they did in the 19th century, that we're still really creating the Horace Mann 19th century factories for education, which means that you're concentrating as many students in one location as possible, which inherently means that if something bad happens, it can have broad impact on a lot of young people. There's, I think, a radical question that could be asked about schools of rather than making them hermetic and insular and isolated as institutions, does weaving them into the community in a way that the children within the school are familiar with a lot of the pillars of the community, if you will, mm-hmm. and that the people within the community feel like they have a certain sense of responsibility for the success and culture of the school, would that be helpful rather than really making schools that are so focused on security and trying to kind of, say, protect children from the outside world?
Phil Horton is head of architecture at ASU's Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts.
And finally, from the Fronteras desk, tribal and environmental groups have filed a lawsuit against the federal government demanding it makes a plan to clean up a coal mine that has displaced many families on the Navajo Nation. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
The lawsuit says federal regulators within the Interior Department, an owner of the Navajo Generating Station, unlawfully renewed the permit to operate the Peabody Mine when they should have come up with a plan to close it. The mine feeds the Navajo Generating Station, which is scheduled to shut down next year if a new buyer doesn't take over. Dene Cares' Adela Begay said in a statement, quote, "For the past 50 years, Peabody has locked up these lands for a single industrial use, and we have seen nothing from federal regulators explaining how our lands will be repaired and our water restored." Still, many tribal members, including the 800 people employed by the mine and power plant, want the industry to stay. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.